like to address one topic, basically one broad topic, because Shlishi of Parshas Vayishlach, and this is our want to focus on Shlishi. Shlishi introduces us to the Isser of Gid Hanasha. And that's a fascinating topic from a lot of perspectives. It's a major topic, lahalacha, but it's also very, very significant as to how it fits in here and what its implications are. And it's going to tie into some of our concepts we've been talking about. To mention first some halachic background about the Gid Hanasha before we try to figure out how it plugs in. So we know that what happens in the parasha here is that Yaakov gets into this fight with a malach, and the malach hits him on the thigh and injures him. And then the pasuk says that because of this injury that Yaakov received in what seems to be parallel to the Gid Hanasha on an animal, however you want to translate that into English, we'll call it the Gid Hanasha. So because of that, so the pasuk says, therefore the descendants of Yaakov do not eat the Gid Hanasha ad hayom hazeh. So we'll have to reflect exactly on what the impact of that statement is. But first of all, just to give some background, so it's a machlokus in general what the nature of the Isser of the Gid Hanasha is, as far as practically speaking, do we assume that it's an Isser Achila, or do we assume that it's more than that, that it's Asser Bahana? It's a discussion in the Gemara. It's not 100% clear how we paskim. The Gemara in the second parak of Psachim has a discussion that when the Torah prohibits something with the language of Achila, does it mean to say that really Achila is a word representing all types of usage and it's Asser Bahana as well? Or should we assume that no, that Achila is precise? It means that we're not allowed to eat that item, but hana is mutter. So the major example of the case where it's clear in the Torah that hana is mutter is nevela. You have a nevela, it's clear that the prohibition is only about eating. You have an animal that wasn't properly shechted. The Torah says specifically that you can give it to a dog to eat. It's you can sell it to a non-Jew. It's clear that it's not prohibited behana. So that's a whole discussion, whether that's the exception, is that the rule, where exactly does Gid Hanasha fit in? And it's a little bit of a machlokas. It sounds like from the Rambam, lahalacha, that we say Gid Hanasha is mutter bahana. The Gemara seems to say pretty clearly that one can sell a Gid Hanasha. So it sounds like it's mutter bahana, but there's still some ambiguity. It still continues to be a little bit of a machlokas harishon. But that's just some background to keep in mind, first of all. And it also emerges from the Gemara that the prohibition of Gid Hanasha does not apply to a non-kosher animal. Obviously, other isurim from any of the non-kosher animal, but it won't carry with it the isur of Gid Hanasha. And the Torah Tamima emphasizes that drasha is a specific drasha. In other words, to tell you that this is not simply because we have a principle of Ein Isser, Chal Al Isser, that we don't have new prohibitive statuses coming into something that's already prohibited. Here it's something else. Presumably what he's trying to say is that the Gid Hanasha is only significant when it's in the context of an animal that's otherwise permitted. So this is allowed, and this part is not allowed. But if the whole animal is also anyway, so then there isn't going to be any specific focus in the Gid Hanasha, and therefore the Isser doesn't really have room to kick in. Again, I'm mentioning these halachic points specifically because I think they're relevant a little bit to understanding the Hashkafa of the Isser as well. And so there is a discussion then about whether or not the Isser applies to Basar Adam, for the cannibals among us who are considering whether there's a specific Isser of Gid Hanasha by people. So here the Rashba has in his Tshuvas, quoted by the Mishnah Melech, saying that there is an Isser, and the Shah HaMelech says that this is the Rashba L'shitaso, because the Rashba says we don't have a specific Isser of cannibalism in the Torah, in his understanding. Again, public service announcement, do not try that at home. It's not to suggest that cannibalism is by any means mutter, but in terms of whether it's treated like a trade food specifically, so the Rashba seems to not see it in that context. So therefore, the general exclusion of a behemoth mayor, he doesn't see as applying. But of course, it's also relevant because if we're looking to model after the initial Gid Hanasha, so that was, of course, a person. That was, of course, Yaakov. So again, I'm mentioning these points not just because of the practicality, but they're important to keep in mind when we try to understand the correlation between the original incident and the Isser as is practiced today. Just mention at one point more for the story value and the Dam L'Chatzchus value. So one of the greatest achronim in history was Rav Yonah Sinaipshus, who was a tremendous gaon. Was very well known for many things, but he was certainly a tremendous, tremendous gaon. And he was the author of, among many other svarim, the Crazy Uplacy on Yerideya. So there's a statement over there in the Crazy Uplacy in Yerideya, which many criticize. They say he makes a simple mistake there. How could somebody of his stature make such a simple mistake? Because he says over there that he was responding to someone. There was someone who claimed that the Yisr Get Hanasha is only relevant to male animals. And Crazy Uplacy, Rabbi Anderson pointed out to him that, no, look, it says in the Smak that it's Noheg V'Zacharim U'B'Nekevis. Applies to males and to females. So everyone criticized him for this. Everyone jumped on him on this for this and said, what do you mean? That doesn't mean that it applies to female animals. If you ever learn the Sefer Achinuch, for example, so you know at the end of every mitzvah, the Sefer Achinuch tells you who the mitzvah applies to, where it applies, when it applies. Does it apply only in Eretz Yisrael? Does it apply in the rest of the world too? Does it apply only to Zman Beis HaMikdash? And it tells you, does it apply only to men, or does it apply to women also? So this language, Noeg B'Zacharim B'Nekevis, means that both men and women are prohibited from eating the Get Hanasha. It doesn't mean that female animals also have the Get Hanasha. How could a great going like Rav Yonah Sinaipshus make such a simple mistake in reading this map? So the chances are he did not make such a simple mistake. And the some of the later Sfarim, there's a whole back and forth about this. Some sofers are true about this. There's a lot of literature about this. And then the later Sfarim, they point out that probably there is a mistake here, but it's not the great Gaon Rav Yonah Sinaipshus making a mistake like that. It's a typo. That it doesn't mean to say the smag, samach mem gimel, but maybe it means to say samach hey gimel. Maybe it means to say sefer halachas gedolos, because if you look in the sefer halachas gedolos, it says that the Isser of Get Hanasha applies both to male and female animals, which presumably that's what he was talking about. And so the reference was not to this line in the Smag, it was to this more relevant line in the Sefer Halachas Gedolos. And then the story continued until it was eventually published in the journal HaPardes. This is quoted in the Pardes Yosef, not related to the journal HaPardes, but I think also, I saw this once in one of the English books, I think the book Chulin Illuminated, the picture book about Chulin, I think they tell you this whole story over there where it talks about Get Hanasha, just in case it helps you understand the picture. So there was a Rav from Los Angeles, Rabbi Neches. So he pointed out that he has an original printing of the Crazy Uplacy from the time of Rav Yonah Sinaipshus, which has emendations in his handwriting. So there he sees that it's not Samach Mem Gimel, not the smag, but that it should have said samach hei nun, that there's an old sefer called the sefer hilchos nikur. Nikur is how you remove the Get Hanasha from the animal. So there it says that it applies to zacharim, meaning sharim, meaning bulls, and it applies to nekevos, meaning paros, meaning cows. So there, that's explicit. It's talking about animals. So once again, a great gaon like Rav Yonah Sinaipshus doesn't have to bear the insult of having made a mistake like that in a simple misreading of the phrase Noeg B'Zacharim B'Nekevis. But it's also an interesting lesson in being Dam L'Chav Sfus, because he also points out there that nobody ever bothered to look in the Smag. And it says in the Smag, it doesn't have the sentence. So everyone, the assumption was that, oh, how is he misunderstanding the Smag sentence of Noeg B'Zacharim B'Nekevis, which means it applies to human men and to human women, when that sentence isn't even there, so that can't be what he meant, and clearly he meant one of these other versions. Okay, so in any event, so that's a little bit of a deviation from the model. So the original subject of the Get Hanasha was a human male, but okay, so it's a machlokas whether it applies to humans, but whether it applies to female animals, that it seems to be agreed upon, perhaps, that it does apply to female animals. So it's also relevant, and this is a big yesod, and part of the saying it's a big yesod, as we'll see, because the Rambam says that as well, that there is a major discussion here, just in terms of how we relate to Torah and mitzvot. There's a major, major point that emerges from the interaction of this iser, this mitzvah in the Torah, the Get Hanasha, and the reference in this week's parasha, the reference in Shlishi, that here the Torah says, Al Kain, because of this, we don't need to get Hanasha. So what does that mean? Does that mean there was a mitzvah at that time? And if you learn the Sefer Achinuch, I mentioned a few minutes ago, learn the Sefer Achinuch, you'll see his Lashonos. So the Sefer Achinuch is organized based on the Parshios. So he lists all the mitzvahs based on where they appear in the Torah. And therefore, most of them are not in Bereishis, because the Torah is not given yet. Klal Yisrael doesn't exist yet as a nation. So in the Sefer Achinuch, you only have three mitzvot that are in Sefer Bereishis. And one of them is in Parshas Vayishlach. One of them is Gid Hanasha. He lists Gid Hanasha here in this Aliyah in Parshas Vayishlach. So it may not have much of a nafkamina, but one could argue that it shouldn't be there, that it shouldn't be listed in Parshas Vayishlach, especially for the Sefer Achinuch, who is so loyal to the Rambam in general. The Sefer Achinuch built his listing on the Sefer HaMitzvot of the Rambam, but the Rambam doesn't organize it by Parshios. The Rambam lists the Sefer HaMitzvot, so he just has positive mitzvahs and negative mitzvahs, and he goes in the order that he thinks is relevant. But the Sefer Achinuch, who has a lot of faithfulness to the Rambam, but he has this order of going through the Parshias, and one could argue that maybe it shouldn't be there. Why it shouldn't be in Vayishlach? Why shouldn't it be in Vayishlach? Because the Rambam has a comment in the Perush HaMishnayis Tuchulin on Daf Kuf Midbeis, where he says, there's an Iker Gadol. I'm going to tell you a very important principle that one should understand, that this is a big deal, he says, that all the mitzvot that we observe today, we observe them because they were given to us at Hasina. That is the machayiv of the mitzvot. And anything that happened earlier is not relevant to us as a tzibur. So therefore, to give another example, let's say the Sefer Achinuch's listing, the second mitzvah in the Sefer Achinuch is the mitzvah of Bris Milah. So the Torah says, in the context of Avraham Avinu getting a Bris Milah, that we do that too. So it says the Rambam, but that doesn't mean that we have a mitzvah of Bris Milah because Avraham did it then. The Torah was mitzava as a Har Sinai to give a Bris Milah. So that's where it comes from. So this seems to be what the Mishnah is saying. It seems to be he's actually interpreting the Mishnah pretty much directly, even though the Rambam spells this out clearly. So again, you could ask then, so maybe the Sefer Achinuch shouldn't have put it in Vayishlach. I should have put it later on. It wouldn't be clear which part should have put it in, but maybe it's only historically connected to Vayishlach, but not as a mitzvah. But in any event, it sounds like the Rambam's really pretty much interpreting what the Mishnah says, because the Mishnah over there, Daf Kuf Amud Beis in Chulin, so there is a machlokis to Behuda and Chachamim that we just mentioned a few minutes ago, that we assume that there is no prohibition of Gid Hanasha by a non-kosher animal. So Rabbi Yehuda is quoting the Mishnah saying, how could there be such a distinction? Before the Torah was given, there was no distinction between kosher animals and non-kosher animals. And this mitzvah comes up in Parshas Vayishlach before the Torah was given. So at that point, there's no relevance to this distinction. So how could this Isser be divided along those lines when there was no meaning to such a distinction? So there, Chachamim responded to Rabbi Yehuda, and they said, no, it was given at Sinai. And Balama Nichtava, why is it written over here in Parshas Vayishlach? In order to tell us the reason. So it sounds pretty much, you could argue maybe a little bit on the meaning, but it sounds pretty much like what the Rambam is saying, that really the Tzivoy comes from later on in the Torah. And it's mentioned here because to help us understand its historical significance and to help us to understand the reason, but this is not the Tzivoy. This is not, maybe there was a minute-bit discussion from the Sfarim, because also the Torah uses the word Ad Hayom Hazeh, so what does that mean until then, until now? Would that mean that it continues from then because of that reason? So that's a question, but it does sound like that's the majority opinion of the Mishnah, to tell Rabbi Yehuda that no, don't worry, there is such a distinction, because when the Torah was given, the Torah gave it both mitzvos, that there's a difference between kosher animals and non-kosher animals, and there's a prohibition of the Gid Hanasha. So it doesn't have so much of an afkamin, it has a lot of alumdish implications, which one could spend a lot of time on. But the Rambam again says this is a big yesod, this is a big ikker. And it's also interesting, so why does the Torah go so out of its way to highlight a reason when it's often not the case that the Torah necessarily focuses on a reason for the mitzvot? So there's a nice discussion about this in a sefer called Arugas Abosem. There is a classical sefer, Tshuvas, called Arugas Abosem, but this is a contemporary sefer with the same title, different person, who is the brother-in-law of the author of the Chavetzela Sasharim, some more well-known contemporary sefer. It's also an older title. It's an older sefer called the Tshuvas Chavetzela Sasharim. It's the contemporary author who used that title for his Chidushim on the Parsha. So his brother-in-law wrote a sefer, Arugas Abosem. It's also a reusing of an older title. So in the Arugas Abosem, so he has a discussion about this. And he says, so what's the idea? Why is there such a focus on the Tam here? He says, perhaps the Torah is trying to tell us that this is not an isser that should be viewed as normal machalas asuras, that this is not tray food in the typical sense, and goes on to discuss many possible nafkaminas at that point, but that this is a mitzvah that's all about zikaron. This is a mitzvah that's meant to connect to a certain message, and therefore the Torah is emphasizing what that message is because that's important. He doesn't make this comparison, but it's evocative of the comment of the Bach. The Bach comments in the mitzvah of Sukkah that the Torah quotes the pasuk of that Sukkah, "L'man yeshvu dorasechem ki besukkah so shavti es bnei Yisrael," that we should sit in the Sukkah because we should know that God put us in Sukkahs in the Midbar. So it's unusual for the Torah to quote a Tam HaMitzvah like that. So the Bach says the reason the Torah quotes it is because the implication of the Pasuk is that separate from any consideration of mitzvahs richas kavana or not, separate from any issue of whether mitzvahs require us to have intent or not, there's a specific din by the mitzvah of Sukkah that we should know what it's about, that we should connect to the historical background, and therefore the Torah goes out of its way to say l'man yedu d'raseichem, and the Torah quotes that l'halacha. So maybe there's a similar notion here, that the Torah wants us to remember that this notion of the Git HaNasha is connected specifically to that historical episode, and therefore, even though the mitzvah came much later, but it's mentioned here so that we should recall that we should connect, and therefore the Sefer HaChinuch, which actually here in front of me, I just noticed, so the Sefer HaChinuch should have it in Mitzvah Gimel, even in Parshas Vayishlach, even if that's not the Tzivoy, he helps us to remember that that's the historical context. So, what's interesting, and this is something I've alluded to a little bit in our Hanukkah discussions, and I want to spend some time on now, is that to say that this is a mitzvah of Zikaron is a nice idea, but it's particularly difficult conceptually, because normally, so we're learning the Sugis of Hanukkah, so if we want to remember something, so we'll light a candle in our window, we'll put up a memorial, we'll set up some positive way to help us remember. But if we're trying to remember something, to stay away from something, it's hard to understand, as we mentioned some points in the context of Hilchos Hanukkah that way, that to say that we have a mitzvah not to eat something so that we will remember something. And why don't we do like Pesach night? We have matzah to remember. We don't stay away from things in order to remember by itself. And especially if you think about it, so for us Jews, most of us are not butchers. So the impact of the Isser Git HaNasha will mean for most of us that we will never come into contact with a Git HaNasha. So how does that help us remember anything? How does that accomplish anything? So I want to consider that point for a few questions, for a few moments, and maybe in the context of doing so, let's look at some of the different suggestions as to what really is the message. What is it that we're supposed to remember? So since the Chinuch is in front of me, I'll read the Lashon of the Chinuch. So, just because it happens to be here. So, he writes that the Mishor She Mitzvah Zo, Kidei She Tia Remez Li Yisrael, She'afa Pi She Yispalu Tzoros Rabbis Begolios Miat Ha'amim Miat B'nei Esav, She Betuchim Shlo Yovdu. That this is a remez to the Jews, that they should know that even though they'll go through a horrible time in Golis from the nations of the world and the descendants of Esav, that they should be confident they're not going to be destroyed. Elo La'olam Yamod Zarem Ushmam V'yavu Lahem Goyal V'yagolim Miat Tzar. That God will protect them and their merit will stand up and they will become saved. And that will keep them in their faith by remembering this. That this Malach who was a Sar Shal Esav, Ratzel Akul Yaakov in Olam, who Vizarov La Yachalo, he wanted to uproot Yaakov from the world, him and all of his descendants, Tziarov and the Gias Hayarech, and he hurt him by hitting his thigh, Vachain Zer Esav, and Tzal Zer Yaakov, and so too the descendants continue to have problems. Ubasov Tiel and Teshua Mehem, but in the end there will be a redemption. Kamosh Matsinu Ba'av, Shazarchalo Hashemus, the Apostle, Venoshim and Atzar, just like we see by the Father that the Son eventually came up and cured him. And that's what's going to happen. That ultimately there will be a Yeshua. We should remember that just like there was by Yaakov. It's interesting the language he uses right before this. He says you shouldn't think that it's Dhamma's story. He says right before he gave that reason, he says, V'hai lo yochlu, the language of the Pasuk, Al-Kem lo yochlu v'nei Yisrael ha-segit ha-nasha, says this language, lo ne'amar al-derach sipor, this is not Dhamma's story. Just because this happened to the father, so its kids don't eat it. But rather, it's a mitzvah. So basically, this is the way the Sefer Achinuch understands it, that it's a zikaron, that we will be able to prevail despite all of the suffering that we'll have at the hands of the descendants of Esav. We'll eventually succeed and we'll eventually be rescued. So again, that presents us with a little bit of a challenge, because if it's meant to be a zikaron, so how are we going to remember anything if we never come into contact with this? It's a negative zikaron. So before coming back to that point, there are those who see it in a way maybe that's a little bit easier to understand like this. For example, in the Zohar, it sounds like when the Zohar talks about this mitzvah, that it's about staying away from the influence of Rishayim, that here Esav touched this place, he had an influence there, he had an impact there, and therefore we recognize that that's dangerous for us, so we should stay away from it. So that's perhaps a little bit easier to relate to from that perspective, not necessarily as a zikaron per se. The Orach Chaim in his commentary here writes that it was moved away, it jumped away from its place of Kedusha, so therefore it has a tumah, and that's symbolic of all that's been touched by tumah, and therefore we have to factor that into our behavior. The Netziv has a comment which I don't totally understand. If you look at the comments of the Netziv on this Aliyah, there's some that are a little bit difficult to see what he's getting at. But we'll just mention it to be comprehensive here. So the Netziv writes that he thinks that this is to tell us that we shouldn't be rigid like a gid, like the nerve is rigid, the sciatic nerve is rigid. One shouldn't be like that. One should be able to be flexible, and therefore they're not going to break as easily. So he feels that that's a little bit what's going on here. I'm not 100% sure how he sees that in the Pesukim, but again, you can take a look, see, tell me if you understand it a little bit better. But there is also an approach that the Rishonim have. You find this in the Chizkuni, in the Tosfos Arash, in the Das Kehim of Balei Tosfos, that this is a punishment, not to Yaakov, but to his descendants, right? The descendants of Yaakov don't eat the Gid Hanasha because of what happened to Yaakov, Al-Kain. What does that mean? So these Rishonim say that the children of Yaakov were guilty for not fulfilling the mitzvah of Levaya, the mitzvah of escorting someone. We associate the mitzvah of Levaya with the mitzvah of Hachnasas Orchim, that there's a mitzvah to have people hosted in your house. And then when they finish eating, you don't just send them on their way and expose them to the elements, but there's a mitzvah to escort them out. They should be protected, they should be honored. That's a part of the mitzvah. The Rambam, when he talks about the obligation of the Chasorchim and Avram Avinu, he gets very emphatic about how crucial Levaya is to Hachnasas Orchim. Nowadays, it's kind of fallen into a little bit of neglect, and there's a whole discussion in the Poskim. Why is that? If Levaya is so important, how come we don't find that the hosts are so worried about that anymore? So that's a whole discussion. But apparently, you have nowadays Hachnasas Orchim without Levaya. So you also have the inverse. It's clear from the Gemara, you could also have Levaya without Hachnasas Orchim. That it's not just that somebody was staying in your house, but if you see somebody wandering around in the street and he's lost, it's not his neighborhood, he doesn't know where to go, and he's vulnerable because he doesn't know which alley to turn into. So therefore, the people who are the natives, who know the neighborhood, they're supposed to help him around. They're supposed to make sure he gets to the right place. And that's a mitzvah Levaya, which is not connected to Hachnasas Orchim per se. So why was Yaakov by himself? Why was Yaakov left? Okay, we know the whole story. He went back because of the Pachim Ketanim. That was last year's Aliyah. But the fact is, here he is vulnerable and exposed, and he has all these children and all these strong young men who could be protecting him, and nobody is. So there was a bittul of Levaya. That's how these Rishonim understand, that there is a guilt to the descendants of Yaakov, and therefore they lose out. So again, that's a little bit more understandable in terms of the negativity, Shabbos, saying that there's an issue. The Tosla Rush has a language that they lose a Michael Tov, they lose this good Gishmak of meat because they were not careful enough to escort their father. That's a whole discussion, because it sounds like from the Gemara that doesn't have any taste at all. It says, Ain't beginning but no St. Tom, it sounds like it's completely tasteless. So what do they mean by that? So some explain that the Gid itself is tasteless, but it's woven in with some very tasty meat, so there are cuts of steak you can't get in America because there's no way to prepare it in a kosher style, in a kosher fashion. So, okay, so we pay a price. We lose out on some good beef because we failed to do the Levaya to the ancestor, to Yaakov. So that's how some understand. And again, if that's the focus, so it's a little easier to understand. Okay, we stay away from this. We lose out because of this failing, and it's not necessarily they were supposed to see something and remember. The Rashbam goes back to the idea of remembering. He says that this is to remember the Gvura of Yaakov, and to show that the injury that he has doesn't mean anything to us. So that also perhaps we could use to understand a little bit more why we remember if we're negative, because the point is we want to minimize what this is. That this Yaakov survived and he was injured. So what are we going to focus on? Are we going to focus on the injury or are we going to focus on the survival? So we want to point out that Yaakov survives and the injury is not important. That whatever happened, whatever he went through, is not something that's significant. So how do we show it's not something significant? That to get Hanasha, we don't ever get involved with. We don't have anything to do with it because it's Eitz Ba'alma, it's irrelevant to us. And that, by the way, one could also suggest that if we do assume there's an Isser Hanah for the Get Hanasha, which we said is a subject of a discussion, so if there's an Isser Hanah, so in general it's a good question to try to understand what does it mean when there's an Isser Hanah. It's a whole sugi in of itself. What is the impact of an Isser Hanah? So one could say that when the Torah prohibits something b'hanah, it's a way of saying that one is not supposed to value that item at all. One is not, it's the whole question whether Isser Hanah have any monetary value. Is it possible to sell something that's Aser b'hanah? Is it possible to transfer property that is Aser b'hanah? So perhaps the message of something being Aser b'hanah is that we're not supposed to be machshav at all. We're not supposed to give it any value in our eyes. We're not supposed to treat it with any importance. And therefore, if that's the case, so then, again, maybe it's understandable that that's the Isser, it's a negative Isser, that because we're not supposed to be machshav this, so we shouldn't pay attention to it. We shouldn't have anything to do with it. We're Aser b'hanah, shouldn't have any place in our lives. With Moshe Feinstein, and the Dibros Moshe, so he has an approach where he's actually the one source that I saw so far that actually asked the question straight out. He says, if this is Zikaron, so then how could we have an Isser be Zikaron? It's the opposite of whatever approach we take by anything else. So he suggests that even though the message is that we survived this Nisayon, we survived this challenge, but we want to more emphatically say that it's better not to have Nisayonis in the first place. And we pray every day that we shouldn't be brought into the path of Nisayon. So therefore, that's how he understands it, that we stay away from this completely in order to make the message that, yes, we're happy to survive the Nisayon, and we'd be even happier if we didn't have the Nisayonis. Okay, could be. But maybe we could mention one other mahalach, or we could suggest one other mahalach. So first of all, it's an interesting question. What exactly does the word Gid Hanasha mean? What is the word Hanasha? So if you look at Rashi, Rashi quotes from the Gemara that Shanasha Minkomo, that it seems like it jumped away from its place, that there was this injury and the Gid jumped from one place to the next and therefore it got this name. He brings a Raya from a Pasuk in Yirmiyo. The Gemara seems to sound like that. That's what the word means, which is an interesting idea. Rav Nevin Sal Shlita, in his Sichos, so he suggests and he discusses that the word Nasha sounds like it means something else. That we know that one of Yosef's sons was Menashe, and he explains, Ki Nashani Hashem es Kalamali, that God helped me to forget all of my problems. So the word seems to mean to make someone forget. And he has a whole essay there, this is in the Sefer Bereishis, where he talks about the whole nature of forgetfulness and the fact that we have the ability to forget in this world is a good thing and a bad thing. I think I mentioned at some point the story when I was a little child. He said to my father that I think it would be a great thing if somebody could invent a machine which would help us to forget things. So he was so impressed by that, he said, you're right, people have traumatic experiences, they go through awful things and it makes them hard for them to live, and if they could forget things at will, everything would be better for them. And I can't believe you had such a deep insight at such a young age. And then I went on to say that, yeah, if you had such a machine, then you could read mystery novels twice. And that was not what he thought I was getting at, and significantly less impressed by that explanation. So there are milas to forgetting, either that you can read mystery novels twice, or that you can go through life without having trauma weigh you down. So that is a big deal. You don't have to pay the price of embarrassment forever, because even embarrassment, which is so painful, but ultimately it fades because human nature is to forget. And then he points out there, which is a point that Goldrath Hashiv Karen Biavna has in his writings as well, that that's a human thing in this world, that we forget our bizyonis. That in the next world, the bizyonis are permanent. That's why we always say that we'd rather be mavuz in this world than the next world. We'd rather get a kapara in this world, because that will ultimately fade. But our averis that will embarrass us in the next world, that's a permanent bizyonis. That's pretty scary. So we'd always rather go through bizyonis in this world than have to pay the price in the next world. But we benefit to a certain extent from being able to forget things that are harmful to us from progressing. But obviously, forgetting can be bad as well. We don't have to really come too hard, work too hard to come up to an example about how forgetting gets in our way. But there's forgetting that's a natural type of forgetting. We're human, so we don't remember everything. We wish we could remember everything we learned without any effort, but it doesn't work that way. But there's also an intentional kind of forgetting. And then there's an Isser in the Torah. The Torah says, Hishamar l'cha u'shmartim ol v'nefeshecham, something like that, pentishka chesedvarim ha'ilu, that we should not forget the words of the Torah. It sounds like it's an Isser to forget, but the way we understand it is that it's an Isser to intentionally forget, to do something that allows the memory of the Torah to fade. That's a big problem. Baron Cutler used to say that there is an Isser of Bittul Torah. So we talk about Bittul Torah means that if you're doing something else, you're not learning, so that's Bittul Torah. But he says it could be learning, and it could also be Bittul Torah. Because there's Bittul Torah be'ichas, Bittul Torah be'kamas. That there's a Bittul Torah in terms of quantity and of quality. So if you're not learning, then that's Bittul Torah. But there's also a qualitative Bittul Torah, that if you just keep plugging ahead, and you never chazer, you never review what you learned before, so then you're going to forget everything you learned the first time. So even though you could be learning 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but it still boils down to Bittul Torah, because you're not protecting the Torah that you have. So it's a question what exactly it means. We say there's an Isser to forget the Torah, so it could mean that you're not responsible. It's interesting that the Torah uses that double language of Hishamer, Shmarta, really be careful, do what you can, that even though it's human nature to forget, it's the reality of life, but it's your obligation to try to do as much as you can to hold on to it. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes this in a tshuva, that he says that there's a chiyuv to learn Kol HaTorah Kula. How do we know that? Because the Mishnah says that if somebody forgets any of his learning, so then he is mischayev benasho. So it can't be that forgetting is worse than never learning in the first place. In the Mela, you have a chiyuv to learn everything, Kol Torah Kula first, and then you have a chiyuv to keep chazering it until you're sure you're not going to forget any of it. That's quite a standard. So he was discussing, like the Gemara says in Menachos, that if somebody's learned Kol Torah Kula, can you now move on? So Rav Moshe writes, what does it mean to learn Kol HaTorah Kula? First, you have to learn Kol HaTorah Kula, then to the degree that you're not going to forget anything. So probably less than half of us have fulfilled that standard already, so it's not such a relevant question. But in any event, so the idea of there being a prohibition of forgetting, Rabbeinu Yonah in that Mishnah says it doesn't really mean like that. He says that it's a reference to Dayanim, that if you have somebody who thinks he knows the Torah because he feels he's learned it before and he's overconfident, and really, he's forgotten it, so he's going to make mistakes in his dayanus. He's going to issue bad rulings because he thought he knew it and he didn't. So it's not necessarily like Rav Moshe's Kal v'chomer, that never learning it in the first place is worse than forgetting it. So Rabbeinu Yonah is saying, no, that you're worse if you think you know it because you forgot it, than if you know you don't know it because you never learned it in the first place. But in any event, so all that aside, so there is a specific issue of trying to forget things. Putting yourself in a position where you are going to forget your learning. And Rav Nevensal suggests that this is really the offense of Esav, that Esav somehow instilled this koach hatuma, the sorrow shel Esav, the malach, instilled this koach hatuma into Yaakov, meaning the ability or the problem of forgetting his legacy and forgetting the message of Emunah that exists in the descendants of Yaakov, because that was the attack of Sarosh Shalefzav, was meant to instill this forgetting quality. And he goes on to point out how you see this, of course, this is our time of year, and this is what we're learning now, the whole sugya of Hanukkah. Right? So what do we say in Nal HaNisim? We say that what was the goal of the Avanim? L'hashgicha mitarasecha, that they wanted to make us forget about the Torah. And this is a particularly serious risk that's beyond any specific Aveira, but the idea that we would forget about the Torah, that's the scariest notion. And he suggests that that's also pshat, it's not as timely, but Tisha B'Av work. So we know the Gemara in Gittin about Tisha B'Av and about Kamsa Bar Kamsa. So just to say very briefly, the Gemara there says that Bar Kamsa wanted to turn in the Jews and get them all killed, and he did so by soliciting a korban from Caesar and putting a defect, putting a mum in it, and then he knew the Jews were not going to want to sacrifice that, so that would get them in trouble with the Malchus. So the Gemara says that Rabbi Zechariah ibn Avkulis, he paskin that you can't kill the Rodef, you can't do anything to stop this guy from telling on them. And then they said, well, let's bring his korban anyway, even though it's a balmum, so we won't get in trouble with the Caesar. So he said, no, people will say, yomru balmum mikrimzbeach, that people will think that you could bring a balmum, you could bring an animal with a blemish on the mizbeach. So he refused to bring it, and indeed the Beis HaMikdash ended up being destroyed, and there was a galus, and the Gemara says that everything fell apart, because of Anvasanuso Shah Bizhari ibn Avkulis, because of his modesty, however you want to translate that, that led to a terrible korban. So Rav Neventhal talks about that. He says, what exactly is going on? That he didn't realize, Bizhari ibn Avkulis didn't realize Pikuach Nefesh certainly outweighs bringing a Balmum in the Beis HaMikdash. Clearly, to save the life of even one Jew, you could certainly bring a Balmum. Certainly the whole nation, you certainly could have done this. So what was his consideration? So he had the Chaim Shmulevitz had a mahalach where he said that it wasn't about the Isser of Balmum and Mizbeach. It's not that he was afraid that he'd violate an Isser by doing that. He said, Yomru Balmum is that people will think that this will mislead people as to what the halach is, and then that would get forgotten, that there'd be a Shibchas HaTorah, that there'd actually be a forgetting of the Torah, and that's much more serious than any one specific Aveira, and he thought that was of tremendous consequence, and that was his whole point. That was Rav Chaim Shmulevitz said. So Rav Neventhal commented that when he first heard that vort, he said, okay, that's very nice, but apparently it's wrong, right? Because the Gemara says that Zechariah ibn Avkulis led to a disaster. So apparently this concern that the forgetting of the Torah is such a big deal, that's maybe not correct. Maybe that's not really the way to see it. So then he suggests that, no, that's probably not the case, that really his halacha was right, that this is actually a concern on that level. But where he went wrong is in assessing the situation, because what happened after that? There was a destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, so clearly that's a much bigger source of the forgetting of the Torah, and that led to all kinds of things being forgotten, and that led to the Galus. So if you're worried about the Torah being forgotten, so clearly what emanated from that situation, that was certainly short-term thinking that led to a disastrous result. So the logic is true, that the forgetting of the Torah, that's the biggest deal. But how it was applied in that situation, that was wrong. So in any event, so he goes on to create this whole discussion about how shikha is really our biggest risk, and how we have to work to fight against that through greater learning, etc., etc. So thinking about that question in terms of how it could relate to the Issa of the Gid Hanasha, and the fact that the Gid Hanasha is an Issa rather than a visible Zikara, so perhaps one could say as follows, that the nature of the issue is that, especially when we think about the Ivanim wanted to make us forget that Yaakov was attacked by Esav because Tzaros L'Esav, because to make him forget. What does that mean, to make him forget? How could even the Ivanim, how could they make us forget anything? They could tell us what to do or what not to do, they could control our lives, they could kill us, but how can you get into someone's head and make him forget something? So perhaps what the whole issue here is that in all of these cases, with the Yavanim and with Tzaros L'Esav and also with the Churban HaBayis as well, that you have a tendency to think that if there's major crises going on in the world, so then you can't really focus on details anymore. And you can't worry about the pratim and the content of the Torah. You say, there's a fire raging. How can I learn daf yomi? How can I worry about nuances? How can I worry about pratim? I just have to worry about the crisis. And I'm not going to pay attention to these details. That's for a luxury. When I have time, I'll learn that kind of Torah. But right now, there's a fire raging. There's a crisis. I can't pay attention to all of that. So the impact of such an attitude is that ultimately the Torah gets forgotten, because there's always a crisis. There's a constant barrage of attacks, there's always something coming. And if one takes the attitude that during that time, when there's so much going on, I can't really pay attention to the day-to-day stuff, so then the day-to-day stuff becomes forgotten. And this is in the annals of time management, they talk about this. One of the Chassidi Umas Ha'olam, Stephen Covey, who passed away a few months ago, his writings, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and his other Chashuva books. So he talks about the principles of time management, which others talk about this as well. He says that we often confuse urgency for importance, you know, that there are two different reasons we'll prioritize something. And we'll come back to this also in Hilchos Chanukah, because this is going to come up in Hilchos Chanukah as well, that sometimes we prioritize things not because they're important, but because they're urgent. Like, for example, a ringing telephone. A ringing telephone is not necessarily important, it's just urgent. If you wait a few minutes, it's going to stop ringing, and you'll miss the call. So it's urgent, it has to be answered now, but it's not necessarily important. And very often, those things that are important are not presented as urgent because they happen over the course of a lifetime. So it might feel like coming to Morning Seder is not urgent because it happens every day. Right now there's a final, so whatever it is, it's something else is more urgent. But learning every day is not presented as urgent, but really it's crucially important. So we often trade the important for the urgent. That which is the blaring phone call, it's presenting itself right now, that's the biggest deal. And that takes our attention away from that which is important. It's rare that that which is truly important is always presented as urgent. It's urgent when it's an emergency, when after being neglected for many years, so then somebody doesn't take care of his health for many years, so then ultimately he gets into a medical emergency. But if he was able to pay attention to it on a daily basis, maybe that wouldn't happen. So sometimes importance doesn't become urgent until later, and then it becomes a crisis. So perhaps this is the message here, that by being in a constant state of urgency, we're being attacked by the Avonim, we're being attacked by the Sarah Shalesev, we're being attacked by all the crises of life, so then we're not focused on what's important. So then we're able to neglect that which is important because we always have to pay attention to that which is urgent. So the message is that we have to be able to keep the importance in mind even when it doesn't present itself as urgently, and we have to maintain the connection to the learning on a daily basis, to the mitzvahs, to the tefillah on a daily basis. And again, perhaps that's the message, that this injury that Yaakov had, which seems like a big crisis, okay, he was injured. So the Torah is saying you can't focus on that so much, that the Gid HaNasha should not be the point of our attention, that we focus more on the fact that we want to survive and not worry about this injury, and we survive by reconnecting to the Torah itself. And that's perhaps the message of Chanukah, and the message of the Gid HaNasha, and the message of everything else. So those are just some thoughts about the Gid HaNasha. Before we finish, I'll just mention one other thing in this Aliyah, because it's also a meta concept, just to put it out there. So Aliyah ends by saying that Esav and Yaakov meet, and they hug and they kiss, and on Vishakehu, on the kissing, there's dots on the top. So we've talked, I think, in Parshas Nitzavim this year, we talked a little bit about the significance of dots. We mentioned that this is discussed in Rosh Shechter's forthcoming Sefer, that this is apparently one of the tools of the Torah Shebaal Peh, and not listed among the Midosh and Torah Nidrashas Behem that we have, but apparently this is such a tool, this is one of the vehicles of the Torah Shebaal Peh, that this is a way that something is conveyed to us, that there's a message here. So it has sometimes halachic implications. We saw that in Parshas Nitzavim, Hanistaros, Lashem Elokeinu, there were dots over there that have halachic implications. And sometimes it has narrative implications. Sometimes it's there to tell us something about the text. So Rashi has two interpretations. Rashi says either this is to show that he didn't really kiss him with a full heart, that he didn't really mean it, it was just a gesture. Or kind of the opposite, that halacha hu she'Esav shonei es Yaakov, that it's a given, it's a halacha, that Esav hates Yaakov, and therefore clearly something strange here, but he was able to overcome it for a moment. They were so happy to be seeing each other that at that moment it was real. So some of the Svarim explain, the two Lashonos, that basically there's got to be a Chiddush here. So what's the Chiddush of the dots? What are they telling you? So you could say, even though the Pasuk says that they were kissing, you should look a little deeper and you should realize that it wasn't meaningful, this was just a facade, this was just external. But the other language says, no, clearly it was a facade, because we know that Esav hates Yaakov, we know that they don't really get along. So to say that it wasn't sincere would not be a chiddush. So the chiddush then of the Tatz is that even though Esav saw only as Yaakov, still, in this case, they overcame that for a moment and actually was more sincere. So two opposite perspectives driven by this question of what exactly is the chiddush. Hi.
For the Ashkenazim, those two dots, they also stop. Is that like it's a pause?
So that's also a part of how to understand it, I guess.
So it's, part of it. It's just interesting because both is, I think, I don't know what it's called, but
it's Nachta?
Yeah, is that on the top, right? On the top. Okay. So I think that's also like sort of the pause there.
Okay. So, in any event, so this phrase that we see in Rashi, that the halacha Esav Sonu Yes Yaakov, that's often interpreted to mean that we always have to worry about anti-Semitism, that the Ummah Olam will always hate the Jews. So, it's questionable how much stock one should put in that interpretation. And my friend Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein, in one of his columns, points out that he thinks that people take this a little bit too far, and this often spills out into their attitudes with non-Jewish people, that they feel like there has to be a constant state of war, that halacha Esav Sonu Yes Yaakov, and he doesn't really know where that meaning comes from. He says, he did a search, and before the 19th century, the idea that Esav here is a reference to a nation of Esav doesn't really come up. It's very possibly talking about Esav itself, the person. And the idea that it should be extrapolated to nations as a whole is a much more recent interpretation, and certainly it wouldn't mean in an absolute sense that every other non-Jewish person in the world is branded with the title of Esav. So it's such an important exhortation that on the one hand this is a very frequently cited phrase, but at the same time it's important not to let that have too much of an impact on attitudes and judgments about other people, and not to take it beyond its meaning in a possibly damaging sense. But in any event, what does it mean here? So Rabbi Yashiv has a comment where he noted that whatever issues you have with Esau, so Lavan was no prize either. And it's interesting that Rivka gave Yaakov the advice to run away from Esau and go to Lavan. And we see that things didn't go so well by Lavan either. Lavan wasn't such a fan of Yaakov and his family. So what exactly is going on here? Yeah, Esau hates you. Run away from Esau and go to Lavan. It's not really such great advice. It seems like you're out of the frying pan and into the fire. That's not really so helpful. So he goes on to explain that whatever issues he had with others, but the hatred of Esav was unique. And it comes from the union of Olam Olam Yamatz, that the whole nature of the relationship is that Esav perceived that to whatever extent Yaakov is successful, he's unsuccessful. To whatever extent Yaakov has the brachas and Yaakov grows, that comes at Esav's expense. So that's a particular type of hatred that is particularly dangerous. And that's an important idea to keep in mind as well, just in terms of relationships with other people and what causes tensions, and the whole notion of not to be matal kiddah, not to try to evoke jealousy and the like, is that there are different issues people have with others, but when the perception is that one's success leads to the failings of others, that's a particularly dangerous mentality. And that's always a question, it's an economic question, in terms of communists and capitalists, you know, what exactly is the nature of wealth in the world? When one person is wealthy, does he become wealthy at the expense of others? Or is the idea that people who are wealthy create wealth by their activities, and therefore they benefit at least themselves, but the whole world also, but not at the expense of other people? So that is a philosophical divide a little bit between the communist inclination and the capitalist inclination. That's one of the major themes that permeates a lot of national, international debates, but part of it is highlighted by this fact that there's a particular hatred that comes when one feels that another's success comes at that person's expense, and perhaps that's where Esav had a particular hatred towards Yaakov that even was worse than whatever Laban or anyone else would have had against him. Okay, so those are some of the major themes in this Aliyah. On Sunday, Gavrilin will continue with another Malacha, and then back to Hanukkah on Monday as we zoom closer to Hanukkah itself. So maybe if we can all stay, could have Mara quickly. I'm maybe raising hands if you want to leave us.
Time is
should be 11:45. Okay, so you want to madam first? Okay, Asher, should
I stop this? I'll stop this.
I don't know.